contradicted his lean time story, bit into it anyway.
Billy might be an asset then, Dennis told him as he chewed. It might impress your customers to know you're helping out a former GI.
Holtzman considered this, seemed to like it, but then shrugged it off lest Dennis begin to think he had an advantage.
He's a good-looking guy, Dennis went on. Soft-spoken. People like him. Women like him.
Holtzman shrugged again, as if to say Dennis didn't understand the shoe business.
If you would think of it as an investment, not a loan.
It's a lot of money, Holtzman said.
It's what I figure he really needs.
And when would he be in here? Just Saturdays?
Isn't Saturday your busiest day?
Holtzman shook his head.
He'll take a long time to earn back $500 just working on Saturdays.
He'll be paying you off from his salary at Edison, too, Dennis said, and I'll be helping him out.
Holtzman put the sandwich down, daintily wiped his fingertips and then his mouth, turned a little in his chair, as if, Dennis thought, he was about to dismiss him. But then he said, working that tongue into his cheeks, looking over his papers,
I'm thinking of staying open Thursday nights. Gimbel's does it.
Billy could be here Thursday nights, Dennis said. Billy could be here by 5:30 easy.
Holtzman sucked his teeth again, turned to another inventory sheet on the desk before him. It was clear he was becoming more and more interested as he feigned growing indifference, not nearly as sly as he believed himself to be.
What does he know about shoes? He said.
Dennis laughed.
How much is there to know?
And then quickly amended it.
Smitty can show him what he needs, I'm sure.
Holtzman looked up from his desk.
He's willing to do this?
Dennis grinned. He hadn't mentioned any of this to Billy yet.
Are you kidding? He said. He's dying to do this. He's nuts about this girl. It'll be nearly a year. He's dying to see her.
Casually, Holtzman leaned down to slide out the bottom drawer of his desk.
I'll give him $1 an hour to begin. Thursdays till 9, Saturday 9 to 6, $12.50 a week, $50 a month.
He lifted a heavy check ledger from the drawer, tossed it onto his desk, flipped it open.
He adds whatever he can from his regular salary once a month.
What kind of interest do you want? Dennis said.
Holtzman waved the pen he had lifted.
This is family, he said.
And then he added as he wrote, exacting another kind of payment.
You boys will never have any money if you spend everything you make before it's earned.
He might have been talking to a child. Dennis felt the warmth in his cheeks.
This is an advance, Mr. Holtzman, he reminded him. Billy will earn it.
Holtzman lifted his head to give Dennis a shrewd look, a skin-deep look if there ever was one.
But first he'll spend it, he said.
Billy was at his desk when Dennis got back to the office. He put the check in front of him.
Here you go, he said,
and understood for the first time why it was that his father had bankrupted himself and estranged his wife and filled their tiny apartment with far-flung relatives from the other side, simply to know this power, this expansiveness, simply to be able to say, as he said to Billy that day in the office on Irving Place, here you go. Here's your life. Full of himself and of Billy's sweet, blushing gratitude, he decided that day, too, that he would marry Mary when Eva came. Make a good confession for a change, say yes and mean it, rather than have it turn into another instant sin, when the priest behind the dark screen asked him if he planned to marry the girl he was having his way with. He'd give her a ring on the day Billy married Eva, find them a place of their own, get his life started. Why not? He could afford it. He had a rich mother. Why not? Bread was what you wanted over the long haul when you got right down to it. When you got right down to it, you wouldn't want a lifetime of cake. And it would make for a fine summer. Billy wired the money to Eva in April,
and in his next letter asked her to send him her shoe size and the sizes of her younger sisters so he could pick up something for them at the store. This she did, including in her last note to him a folded sheet of butcher paper that contained a tracing of her right foot and each right foot of her three younger siblings. She said she knew that shoe sizes were different in the States and thought this was the best way to be sure of a good fit. She said, too, that she was making this letter a short one. She wanted to catch the postman and would write more later. She said she was busy making plans. In the shoe store that Saturday morning, Billy spread the brown paper out on the counter so Smitty, Mr. Holtzman's assistant, could determine each size. Smitty advised Oxfords for the sisters, and by lunchtime, Billy himself had selected a pair of tan and white spectators for Eva. He had sold a pair to a woman that morning, a young woman who had come in intending only to get her old father fitted with a pair of wingtips. The shoes had made even her thick ankles seem elegant and sporty. The same girl returned twice that summer, once more with her father, once with a talkative girlfriend who did all the trying on and buying. This was the summer that Billy, holding his breath, was going through the mail his mother had left out on the sideboard each evening and finding nothing, as he told them down at Quinlan's, nothing at all from Eva. The same summer that Dennis had begun to keep a tally of all the simple things a Brooklyn-born girl knew that an Irish-born girl had to have explained to her. Like the prohibition against a girl calling a fellow on the telephone. On a Sunday afternoon in late September of 1946, Holtzman told Dennis there was a young lady on the phone and with a disapproving shake of his head, handed him the receiver. Dennis sat beside the three-legged telephone table Holtzman had once retrieved from a pile of junk at someone else's curb. An hour later, he met Mary at the service entrance of her building, on 70th Street, just off Park. He was thinking that if she was expecting a child, then he would, of course, marry her immediately and tell himself that it was the hand of God, his father consulting, moving him toward a future that he only understood now he never honestly wanted. A future in which his own bad luck was the other side of Claire Donovan's sailor's opportunity. But what Mary had to tell him was all about Eva. This was the same week that Maeve, trying to orchestrate her own fate, came into the store by herself. It was a Thursday night, just beginning to get dark, and Smitty was working alone. By way of making conversation, he told her that he wasn't sure if he'd lost his young assistant or not. Mr. Holtzman had simply told him this morning that Billy wouldn't be in tonight.
"We'll have to see if he shows up on Saturday morning,"
Smitty told her, releasing her heel and allowing her to place her foot on the ground and wiggle her toes a bit, leaning over her lap to look at the new shoes and to tell him, finally, no surprise here, that perhaps she wasn't that fond of them after all. Gently holding her ankle, he removed the new shoe and returned it to its box. To save her more embarrassment, she was already blushing to the hairline. He didn't even offer to show her another pair. He simply said as he slipped her foot back into the tan and white spectators, well worn now and out of season, that there were always new styles coming in. She should stop by again sometime. He pushed his footstool aside and held out his hand to help her up, thus lending her, it was a favor he did for every female customer, a moment of regal grace as she stood.
"Try us again," he said gently.
He was a dapper little man with thinning hair and a dark mustache. She was 28 or so, in a brown tweed three-quarter-length coat and a gray skirt and shoes that should have been retired after Labor Day. She had combed her hair into fluffy curls that just brushed her shoulders, and her lipstick was fresh enough to have left a mark on her front tooth. Smitty had been selling shoes for 25 years, 10 at A&S, 15 with Holtzman. He was married with no children, and at this stage of the game, little love. But he had memory enough to know what it had cost her, walking in all by herself, no preoccupying old man or bold girlfriend to hide behind. He asked Dennis later if it didn't seem to him to be the exact way of the world that the very night she decided to take the risk, to throw the dice or spin the wheel and see just what might come out of being by herself in the shoe store with Billy, the two of them, with any luck, all alone, would be the very night, the first so far, that Billy didn't show up. Smitty thought to tell her as he walked her to the door that there was a girl over in Ireland who had his diamond ring. But who could heap that kind of humiliation on anyone? There was no time for it anyway, because once she had gotten through the obligatory trying on of just one pair, once she had discovered that Billy was not indeed in there, she was out the door. Perhaps believing that the time saved on this fruitless visit could be added to the next, when, surely by the law of averages if nothing else, she would not miss him again. It was the very next morning when Holtzman came in that Smitty learned the reason for Billy's absence. His fiancée in Ireland had passed away. Pneumonia. It was just like the man to mention the news only after it had had some effect on the running of the store. Holtzman himself, and Billy, it seemed, had known since Monday or Tuesday.
"He won't be back working here, then," Smitty said, "with no wedding to save for."
But Holtzman shook his head.
"He'll be back."
He patted down a hiccup, touching his heart, the gesture making him appear to be soothing himself, reassuring himself. He liked Billy, knew the ladies liked him as well. Business was booming.
"He just wanted last night off. He'll be here Saturday. He'll stay on."
Confirming what Smitty had begun to suspect, watching Holtzman carefully record Billy's hours but never seeing a pay envelope pass between them, Billy was working off a debt.
"What a blow for him, poor fellow," Smitty said.
Holtzman turned his hand back and forth, as if there were a number of ways to look at the situation.
"Life goes on," he said.
As promised, Billy was in the store again that Saturday morning. Paler, perhaps, perhaps thinner, maybe a new puffiness around his eyes, a whiff of alcohol on his breath.
"I'm sorry for your loss," Smitty said,
and Billy gripped his arm just above the wrist and said,
"Thank you, Mr. Smith. I wish you had met her."
Before his voice broke. There was such perfect trust, such perfect helplessness in Billy's brief touch. Smitty had felt something like it only once before when he'd given his arm to a blind woman on the subway stairs. That Smitty, although he barely came to Billy's shoulder, immediately placed his hand under Billy's elbow as if to offer more support.
"He was at odd ends,"
Smitty told Dennis when Dennis next came by the store.
"I've always said that it's the ones who are always joking who feel things more deeply than the rest of us. It's something I've always said."
Smitty began, in the next months and years, to step back whenever a young woman came into the store while Billy was there, certain that sooner or later the urge to live being as it was, he winked when he said this to Dennis, as close as he could come to indicating that he was talking about sex, the grief would pass, and one of the young women who came in would catch his eye. When Maeve returned sometime in January with her shuffling old father once more in tow, Smitty ducked into the stockroom until Billy was finished with his current customer, and when he peeked out onto the floor, he saw that Billy had the old man's shoe off and was trying to get him measured, the man grumbling all the while, the girl cajoling. Billy patiently lifted the man's thick foot onto the wooden measure and watched it slide off again.
"He's a piece of work,"
Smitty said when Billy stepped into the stockroom to pull the man's size.
"You can smell the beer on him," Billy told him. "He must have had a quart with his cornflakes."
There was a bit of business with the shoehorn, the old man making an awkward circuit of the store with the silver shoehorn still stuck into his heel up under his pant leg, and Billy going after him in a loping, stoop-shouldered run trying to retrieve it. The girl watching, beginning to smile. Billy catching her eye and smiling as well. A start. But of course it was the old man he befriended first, Maeve standing by like some storybook princess awaiting her fate, as Billy discovered that the old man's family on his mother's side was from Mallow as well, and that he himself had more than once ridden on the streetcar in Brooklyn with that storytelling Irishman everyone was so fond of.
"That was your uncle, was it?"
There was the war to discuss, and the Yankees and the Dodgers, the radio sermons of Bishop Sheen, the inconvenience, for a man his age and with his stomach problems, of the midnight fast before Sunday Mass, and the people he'd known over the years who had worked for Con Ed, had worked two jobs the way Billy was doing, had worked for the NYPD, as he himself had done.
When Maeve, my girl here,
indicating her downcast eyes and the parted brown hair,
was 8 years old, her mother passed away on us.
And you can imagine the boundless sympathy in Billy's blue eyes, boundless and unhesitating, and best of all, untempered by the count of intervening years, the years since that everyone else the old man knew handed to him like a shot of diluted whiskey, a cup of tepid tea, as if the time passed since her dying was a kind of comfort. Billy, of course, understood that there was no comfort, not when the love you'd felt had been fierce and true. They sat almost knee to knee, Billy on his footstool, the box of new shoes in his lap. The old man in the worn red leather chair, his hands on the cool steel of the armrests and the tears springing to his eyes, always red-rimmed and rheumy, the handkerchief going to the nose, always swollen and cherry red. As he repeated the story of his wife's life, his own insult and devotion, while Billy, with all the patience, all the time in the world, listened with the attentiveness of an avid apprentice, an admiring acolyte, listened as if he were receiving instruction, if even then he needed any instruction, in the perseverance of grief. Looking on, Maeve saw her father's future with this kind and attentive young man before she had the courage to imagine her own. Or rather, being nun-taught, lives of the saints saturated, the quiet handmaiden saints who, if they had not chosen the better part, were freed by their bustling about with food and drink and dishes from ever having to form a sentence or even a clear thought about how they loved him and why. She saw that only through her father's life, which was all the life she had planned to know, would he gain any part in hers. Maeve's, of course, was not an unusual case.
Unusual for your generation now, as my father put it, but not for ours.
The girl child wedded to the widowed father. Speaking of Maeve, my father had once said that although the joke is always the Irishman, the Irish bachelor, ever faithful to his dear mother, take a look at an unmarried Irishwoman's attachment to her old dad if you want to see something truly ferocious. It was, I suppose, the very image I'd fought against myself in the years after my own mother died, when I went off to Canisius instead of staying at home and going to St. John's or Queen's or Molloy, when I took only short breaks during the summer so that my father would know I had a life of my own, despite him, despite the weight that hit my heart, stomach, chest, bones every time I thought of him alone, waking alone, going off to the office, shopping, eating, coming into the house at 4 a.m. after getting one of Maeve's calls, after getting Billy off the floor or out of his car or into the hospital if that's what was needed. Even when I married Matt and we headed for Seattle. Lives of our own, we said. Self-sacrifice having been recognized as a delusion by then, not a virtue. Self-consciousness more the vogue. Maeve was only 8 when her mother died. My father getting the story in her tiny kitchen over all those cups of tea and slivers of cake she had served him after they'd gotten Billy into bed, over all those nights she had summoned him. There had been another child, an older sister, who died of lead poisoning when Maeve was very small. A policeman's daughter, Maeve had gotten some sense early on of the precariousness of life, the risk taken by simply walking out the apartment door. Her mother, all false courage, touched her father's back, the hem of his coat, as he went out, saving the intake of breath, the sign of the cross, for the moment she saw him gain the street. Anything might happen, and did, and Maeve felt the heavy weight of her grieving father's hand on her shoulder. He might have shipped her off to female relatives, but he managed instead to trade in his beat for a desk job so he could stay alive for her. The nuns at her school were more than happy to take the child in for as many hours as he needed them to, and Maeve spoke often, or as often as she spoke of anything, of the pleasant afternoons she had spent in the tiny courtyard of the convent beside her school, vine-covered walls, a single oak, a statue of St. Francis above a concrete birdbath, one of the Virgin in the crook of the tree, or in its seldom-visited front room, where the silence was palpable, luxurious, punctuated as it was by the soft steps of the sisters going through the hall or up the stairs or stopping in to bring her a glass of ginger ale and some digestive biscuits on a saucer. There would be a frost on the windows, her schoolwork spread before her on a narrow lemon-scented desk, her handwriting, the lovely round perfection of it, her greatest vanity. There was no question when she finished school of having to find a job, which made her the envy of most of her girlfriends who were struggling with stenography and switchboards and getting to the subway by 8. There was no question either that she would join the nuns for good. She did the shopping and cleaned the house and cooked his meals. Lipstick was for weekends, a movie with the girls, a Saturday afternoon at the stores along Jamaica Avenue. Her father drank most evenings, but it was a man's right, and with a wife in her grave, his only solace. And when things got out of hand, when in his cups he growled at her or cursed her or waved his arms about as if her love and attention were cobwebs she'd draped around him, there were the nuns to go to, who would listen quietly and advise prayer, but also make sure that the pastor crooked his finger at the old man next time he and Maeve were at Mass. So she had the attention of men, too. Her father when he was feeling fond of her, and the priests when he was giving her trouble, and the butcher and the fellow at the newsstand, and even on occasion some boys she had known from school. Not the best-looking ones, of course, the homely mostly, the bad-skinned and wet-palmed, the untalkative, which meant a long night of short questions and short answers for them both, who saw in her plainness, her lack of prospects, their own advantage. Billy, she first laid eyes on as he leaned to place a pair of new shoes in Holtzman's window on Jamaica Avenue, his hand held over his heart to hold back his tie. He looked up and smiled, but she knew even then that he would have smiled at anyone. Bringing her father to the store was her way of showing Billy her life in one sweeping glance. Bringing her girlfriend was a flirtation with despair. If he fell in love with her talkative friend, Maeve would, at least in her lifetime, know him. Walking in alone was a dream, but as it turned out, it was another girl's dream. She was the plain one with the father, the one who without him would have become a nun. She was the one who, having chosen this part, must stand steadily by as his future was formed for her. No one gathered in Maeve's living room that evening could have recalled it either, not accurately anyway. How young they had been then, how much these things had mattered. Mac, Rosemary's husband, who had once been as young himself, in the cramped apartment in the childhood bed of his young bride, sat on the brocade under plastic slipcovers couch, his shirt sleeves rolled up, his pant legs neatly tucked above the knee. He had assigned himself the task of cracking the walnuts that had been set out in a porcelain bowl on the coffee table and spreading the pieces of meat out on a paper napkin. He leaned over his work like a watchmaker. He had already walked down to the corner deli once for more rolls and again for a bottle of ginger ale. He had stood on a chair to change a light bulb in the kitchen and swept the wet walk with a broom from Billy's garage, and now he cracked walnuts as if to keep up with a relentless demand, although the pile he had accumulated had already begun to overflow the paper napkin. Billy's sister Rosemary was moving back and forth from the kitchen to the living room, pausing at intervals to glance out the front windows, hoping to intercept any visitor, as she had intercepted us, who might ring the doorbell or knock on the door and disturb Maeve. There was another couple in the living room with Mac, next-door neighbors, and Kate was there, although still without her wealthy husband. Two women friends of Maeve's from the Legion of Mary had installed themselves in the kitchen. An Indian couple from across the street stopped by with a covered dish but couldn't be convinced to stay. Two men from Edison and their wives were just leaving as we walked in. Dan Lynch arrived by bus with a box of bakery cookies. He was changed out of his suit, but looked that much more polished in a pressed sports shirt and Tattersall pants. He took a seat in the living room as well and placed his teacup and saucer on his knee. The narrow house was a gallery of Billy's life that evening. How could anyone help but think it? From the curb where we parked, to the three brick steps, to the cool hallway, dim as a church, that led past the living room, and the staircase to the kitchen, and the backyard where Shortchange, Billy's motley mutt, had begun to whine as soon as she heard my father's voice. How could my father keep from thinking of it? The sight of Billy's car pulled up over the curb in the berm, or left fishtailed out into the street, of the brick-edged gash above Billy's eye, the pale soles of his shoes as he sprawled in the dim hallway, of Maeve standing over her husband in her pink chenille robe. If you can just get him under the arms, Dennis. How could he help but think of her maddening calm on those nights when she went into the kitchen to put the kettle on after they'd managed to drag Billy into bed? The drunk hauled up the stairs and pulled out of his clothes, wounds dabbed at with a cotton ball soaked in peroxide, shoes wiped clean with a wet cloth and set out on the front steps to dry. Just another housewifely task completed.
Would you like a little sliver of cake with that, Dennis?
How could he help but think of my mother on those nights, at home, still healthy, sound asleep in their bed while he sat with Maeve and discussed a solution, a cure? Or of all the nights in the past decade when he came back to our house after Maeve had summoned him and found himself there all alone? It had always been my father's contention that Maeve was as satisfied with the appearance of sobriety as she would have been with the sobriety itself. More so, actually, since real and permanent sobriety would have meant the end of these mad nights, these long days of nursing him and waiting for him, and then what would occupy her time? From the phone that hung on the wall in the tiny kitchen, she would tell my father when he called,
"Oh, Billy went up to bed already, Dennis. I'm sure he's asleep by now."
Or,
"He just left to take short change for a walk."
Letting an hour or two, or even the rest of the night, go by, before she called him back to ask if he would please come over and get Billy out of the street or off the floor, or once away from the door of her bedroom where she had barricaded herself against him. Or he might hang up, convinced she was lying, turning to my mother to say so. And suddenly the phone would ring while the receiver was still under his hand, and there would be Billy's voice, a little breathless but still sober.
"Just got in."
The rattle of the leash behind him and the click of the dog's paws against the linoleum.
"Let me just get her biscuit."
Billy's voice over the telephone. This telephone. How could he help but think of it? We'd been in the house only a few minutes, had walked only from curb to front hall and into the kitchen, when my father reached for the leash that hung from a hook by the back door and said he'd take the poor animal for a walk. Upstairs, Maeve was resting. Rosemary and the two women from the Legion of Mary made it clear that she had insisted no one leave on her account, that everyone should stay, have a drink, eat up all the food. She had insisted that it was a comfort to her to have people in the house, but she needed half an hour or so to put her feet up, to rest her eyes in a darkened room, to take the measure, perhaps, of how she felt now that the ordeal was at long last over. On the wall above the tiny kitchen table that was covered now with casserole dishes and foil-covered cake pans and bakery boxes, there were three red apples made of pressed wood, one with a smiling pressed wood worm poking through it, remnants of a back-to-school promotion from Holtzman's shoe store. In the living room, Dan Lynch was describing another funeral. The church full, the aisles full, the vestibule full, even the steps leading out into the street. It had rained that day, too, but the crowd at the cemetery was so thick that their umbrellas had made a solid canopy. And even if you weren't standing under it, you were so well flanked by other people that only the top of your head and your shoulders could get wet. And out of the crowd, in one silent moment as the coffin was lowered into the grave, Billy Sheehy's dad, all unrehearsed, began to sing. Danny Boy, of course. A lovely tenor that almost sounded like a record being played, what with the raindrops on all the umbrellas. It nearly killed everybody, it was such a moment. And Dan Lynch had said to Dennis when it was over, both of them teenagers then, "Your father would have loved this." But Dennis pointed across the road to another, smaller group of mourners who were just leaving another grave. "My father would be wondering why we hadn't invited them over," he said. Out in the street, a passerby had asked Dan Lynch's own mother if it was a politician they had buried. There were so many people.
"My mother told him yes, but the best kind of politician, because he never ran for anything. He'd go out of his way to shake your hand, to see how you were doing. He would give you the shirt off his back if that's what you said you needed, but he wasn't running for anything and never had, so he was the best kind of politician."
He nodded to put a fine point on it.
"That's what she said. I'll never forget it. I thought that was very good."
"He was actually a streetcar conductor," Kate said to the couple from next door,
"over in Brooklyn."
She was wealthy enough to be proud of the fact, to use it as a marker of how far she had brought her own branch of the family. While the couple themselves, two more Irish-Americans, the man florid, the woman plump, seemed to indicate by their quick nods of approval and their generous ahs that they themselves might have lied about it, said he was a supervisor with the Transit Authority at least. Add a promotion to his history even if he hadn't had one in life. What harm?
He met Sheila on that trolley, Kate said, and to the neighbor couple. Dennis's mother, our Aunt Sheila. There was a story that all the passengers on the trolley applauded when she first spoke to him.
I remember, Dan Lynch said.
She must have been all of 17 or 18 when she married him, Kate said.
And he was well past 40, Rosemary added.
The two Legion of Mary ladies had come to stand beside her in the dining room doorway.
It often happened that way in those days, the taller one said.
It seemed to amount to a dispensation.
You know, the girls so young and the men middle-aged.
She was grave-faced and confident. Even as she leaned casually against the wide doorframe, she seemed ready to take over. Mac was tapping another broken walnut shell into his thick palm.
So there's still hope for you, Danny boy, he said. You may turn up with some sweet young thing on your arm even yet.
But Dan Lynch held up a hand.
I'm long past that possibility, he said,
and laughed and blushed, and then quickly retrieved the teacup and saucer that were about to leave his knee. Rosemary was turning away from us into the darkened dining room behind her.
I think my Michael wants to follow in your footsteps, Danny, she said,
calling as she went to the sideboard, where the Waterford decanter and surrounding glasses were nearly obscured behind a dozen framed photographs.
I told him just the other day that his father and I are off to Florida in 2 more years.
She came back into the living room light, a picture in her hand.
So if he wants to wait until he's 50 to have children, he's going to miss out on 2 first-class babysitters.
Max selected another walnut from the blue porcelain bowl.
He shouldn't be in any hurry, he said, looking over the tops of his glasses. There's still time for all that.
He's 32 years old, Rosemary cried.
It was the echo of an ongoing argument.
That's hardly too soon.
Her husband, putting pressure on the silver nutcracker, would not meet her eye. She turned to the Legion ladies, handing them the framed photograph.
This is Uncle Dan and Aunt Sheila, she said pleasantly, on their wedding day.
The ladies looked and nodded and handed it to Dan Lynch to pass on to the neighbor couple. He paused to look at it too, although among my father's relatives, the photo was as familiar as a crucifix or the portrait of the Sacred Heart, and as consistently displayed.
He was a lovely man, Dan Lynch said as he passed the picture on.
There followed a pause that threatened to get awkward, all of us smiling slightly and looking at the floor.
And where did she meet her second husband? The neighbor woman said softly into it.
Mac winked at her own husband.
These dames can't get enough of this stuff, can they?
He said. And the man smiled and nodded.
Romance, he said, rolling his eyes.
Mac broke another walnut shell.
Well, it's interesting,
the neighbor lady objected, slapping her husband's knee, smiling.
You have to talk about something, Rosemary said, not.
In the shoe store.
Kate spoke like an adult among bickering adolescents.
In Jamaica, the one where Billy used to work.
Ah, the woman said, nodding. Jamaica Avenue. It's Baker's now, not that you'd want to go there now.
Not if you're white,
her husband said, and got Mac to agree with him.
She met him during the war,
Kate went on, keeping her nose above any onrush of working-class bigotry,
when she went in there looking for shoes.
Same place Maeve met Billy,
Rosemary added.
There was a shrewd one,
Dan Lynch said to the men.
That Holtzman.
He counted off on his fingers.
A German,
as if compiling a list of grievances.
Owned his own shop, a big brick house in Jamaica, another out on Long Island, a third place down in Fort Lauderdale. He bought the Long Island house during the Depression from some poor fool who thought Three Mile Harbor out there was going to be the next Coney Island. Holtzman paid practically nothing for it. Paid for it right out of his billfold, Billy said, standing in the driveway of the place. Signed the deed on the hood of his car. Shrewd.
Dennis has it now, Rosemary explained. It's a nice little place.
Dennis and Billy were the ones who fixed it up, Kate reminded them, right after the war.
In Maeve's own living room, on her brocade chairs and sofa, under the warm light of her lamps, no one who thought of it would dare say Eva. Although Kate could not resist mentioning that Billy had never gone back out there over the years, except for that once when he returned from Ireland, back in 1975. She'd had a postcard from him.
Maeve did too, Rosemary said.
She said Maeve had a postcard upstairs stuck in the corner of her mirror from that trip as well. A picture of home sweet home in East Hampton. She turned to the neighbor couple.
The house from the old song, she said.
Billy had written something very sweet on the back. Beautiful wife or lovely girl. She couldn't remember the exact words now. It might have been something from one of his poems. But Maeve had kept the postcard and had shown it to her the other day, Tuesday, after they'd gotten word from Dennis that Billy was gone.
Holtzman was another old bachelor, Kate said, cutting in. He must have been near 60 when Sheila married him, and he hadn't been married before.
That we know of.
Dan Lynch smiled wickedly.
Billy said once that he wouldn't be surprised to learn that Holtzman had a flock of wives buried in the basement.
No, Rosemary said, fighting the tears that the mention of Tuesday had brought. Billy liked Mr. Holtzman. He always got along with him.
Dennis didn't, Kate said.
Mac examined the last three walnuts in the dish. The lamplight showed the pale scalp beneath his thinning, graying hair.
Holtzman didn't marry Billy's mother, he said.
From the kitchen came the sound of the back door opening. Shortchange scurrying inside, my father's voice speaking to her, saying,
Hold on there, girl, and good dog.
The ring of the leash, water running in the sink and the dog bowl being placed on the linoleum.
How did we ever get on to poor Mr. Holtzman?
Kate asked, and Dan Lynch said,
I was talking about Uncle Daniel, if ever there were two men more opposite.
We heard the clink of the cookie jar where the dog biscuits were kept, and my father calling,
Here, girl.
Well, they both married Aunt Sheila,
Rosemary said, but Dan Lynch waved his hand, a meaningless connection.
And they're all in heaven together, Kate said with a laugh. There's that.
I wouldn't be so sure,
Dan Lynch murmured, winking at me.
You know what our Lord said about a rich man getting into heaven.
I saw him throw a glance at Kate, who deflected it nicely by leaning to reach for a shelled walnut and placing it elegantly on her tongue. Rosemary turned to the Legion of Mary pair beside her to say,
I've often wondered how it works in heaven when there's a second marriage. I know it sounds silly, but you have to wonder, you know, who comes first.
The first marriage is the binding one, the tall lady said with an easy expertise.
Max said, Ha! To his wife. See that? You're stuck.
Just as Shortchange, in a post-walk ecstasy, came wriggling through the dining room and into the living room, all cool wet fur and wagging tail and snorting black nose. My father came in behind her, half a dog biscuit still in his hand, just as Maeve appeared in the other doorway, the one that opened onto the dim hall and the stairs. She wore a pale housecoat and was in stocking feet. She had her hand to her throat.
Oh, Dennis,
she said, squinting toward him as the dog made a quick circuit of the room, greeting everyone. She put her fingertips to the back of Dan Lynch's chair.
It's you.
With the excitement the dog brought in with her, the neighbor lady grabbed the arms of her chair and lifted her feet as Shortchange sniffed her ankles.
Nice dog, nice dog.
And Mac held out a walnut, and Kate leaned down to say with puckered lips,
Hello, sweetheart.
It seemed to take a minute for us all to hear what Maeve had said. She said,
I thought it was Billy coming in from a walk.
Dan Lynch struggled to his feet, awkwardly balancing his teacup,
finally placing it on the coffee table on top of the pile of walnuts, and all the while saying, "Have a seat, Maeve, please, have a seat." Shortchange wiggled toward her as she sat down, and Maeve lightly touched the dog's wet fur.
"I thought it was Billy," Maeve said to my father. "You sounded so much like him."
A kind of pain swept my father's face. He was standing just outside the living room doorway, still flushed from the walk, his shoulders still vaguely patterned with raindrops, his coat still holding a whiff of the green spring.
"I'm sorry," he said.
Maeve shook her head, her hand now on her heart.
"I thought it was Billy,"
she said a third time. Even the bit of lipstick she'd worn earlier in the day was gone, and her simple housecoat was colorless, white and beige. She seemed as plain as a blank page. She looked around the room, her eyes weak.
"I was just getting up," she said. "I hadn't put the light on yet."
Now she put her fingertips to her forehead and lowered her eyes.
"I thought Billy was down here with the dog."
Beside me, the next-door neighbor lady clucked her tongue and said, "Aw," with the sound of exaggerated sympathy you might offer a child. The Legion of Mary ladies both put their hands to their mouths. And then Maeve began to weep. Clearly, this was the moment our presence here was meant to deflect. The moment we'd been waiting for, hoping against, staying around to have a drink and eat up all the food. But we were momentarily stunned by its arrival, unsure of what to do. Maeve lowered her face into her own raised hand, the fingers splayed now from forehead to chin, the plain pearl ring, and let out a long, tremulous sigh that was meant perhaps to give her her composure, but instead caught in her throat and formed another kind of sigh, terrible and unbidden.
"I thought he was here," she said through it. "I thought he was right downstairs."
We stared for a few seconds, and then suddenly, as if we had all been caught in that stilled interval between the first thunderclap and the first pelting drops of rain, we began to scurry, moving as though there were windows to close, laundry to be pulled in from the line. Kate and Rosemary were immediately beside Maeve's chair, Kate with a hand on her shoulder, Rosemary patting her knee. The two Legion ladies hurried back to the kitchen, one to boil water, one to fetch a box of tissues. My father grabbed Shortchange by the collar and dragged her out of the room. The lady from next door stood, which seemed a cue for the rest of the men to scatter, as they did, heading for the kitchen just as my father came back through the dining room, where he paused by the sideboard to pour a glass of sherry from the Waterford decanter. He stepped forward, holding the crystal sherry glass in two hands, but Rosemary waved it away.
"She's already had quite a bit," she whispered.
Kate reached out and took the glass from him anyway.
"I thought he was down here with the dog," Maeve was saying. "I thought it hadn't happened after all. It was a dream. He was down here just coming in."
Her voice twisted a little, nearly vanished.
"I thought I'd go down and put the kettle on."
Rosemary said, "There now." Kindly enough, but meaning too, enough of that. "There now." Her sister leaned forward with the glass of sherry.
"Take a little sip, Maeve," she said.
But Maeve raised her eyes to the two sisters, looking from one to the other, maybe looking for some trace of their brother's face, maybe only hoping for understanding. And then she looked beyond them to my father.
"He's gone,"
she said to him alone.
"Our Billy."
My father nodded. His eyes were dark, and he held his lips together so tightly he might have been breaking the news all over again.
"He is," was all he said, because even as he said it, Maeve put her fingers to her lips and whispered,
"I'm going to be sick."
Swiftly, the neighbor lady grabbed the blue porcelain bowl, turned out the remaining walnuts, and handed it to Rosemary, who held it under Maeve's downy chin. "It's all right," she told her, shooting a deadly glance at her sister. There was the smell of sherry. "It's all right, dear."
"Poor girl,"
the neighbor lady said. The taller Legion lady had returned with the tissue box and was now pulling out tissues one after the other as if she were doling out an endless line of rope. She handed them one after the other to Kate, who was holding them beneath the bowl, piling them into Maeve's lap. My father modestly stepped away. An aluminum pot was produced from the kitchen, but Maeve, as Rosemary said, had nothing but the sherry in her stomach, hadn't eaten a bite since Tuesday, and so the sickness quickly passed. When it was over, Maeve sat back against the chair, her hands full of tissues, her face and throat blotched with red but deathly white underneath.
"I'm so sorry," she said with her eyes closed. "I'm so ashamed."
Amid the women's cooing, the two sisters convinced her to stand and go upstairs to rinse her face and change her clothes, to make herself feel better. Maeve nodded, apologizing, coming back to herself, it seemed. Kate took her by the hand. When the two of them were gone, we moved around the living room, sweeping up walnut shells and collecting teacups, straightening doilies and cushions. We could hear the men talking softly in the kitchen.
"The colored people have an expression," the shorter Legion lady began to say. "No one's called home who isn't ready."
"She should have eaten something," the other said.
"It's good for her to cry," the neighbor lady told us, "not to hold it all back, and what a shock for her to think she heard him coming in like that."
The shorter one paused. She was stout, high-breasted like a wren. Wren-like, she wore a beige sweater with a maroon and brown harlequin pattern across the front, and brown stretch pants and tiny beige shoes.
"I saw my husband 3 times after he died," she said softly.
She held an empty teacup and saucer before her in both hands. It made her look like a woman singing an aria.
"In dreams, I mean. The first time he told me about that expression the colored people have, I'd never heard it before. The second time he was sitting right next to me in church. There were lots of flowers and we were talking about how pretty they were. There was a huge snowstorm the day before his funeral," turning to me to explain. "This was back in 78, and we hadn't had too many flowers there. It had bothered me a lot that he hadn't had more flowers, but the dream put my mind at ease."
She paused. There was a thread of tears in her voice.
"The third time he just squeezed my hand and walked away."
She took a deep breath, bending to pick up a crumpled napkin.
"And that was it," she said. "I never have been able to dream his face again. I dream about him, but he's always in the next room, or he's got his back to me, or he's just gone out, or is just about to come in. I never see him. There were those 3 times in the beginning, and then no more."
Solemnly, authoritatively, sweeping a tissue over the surface of the coffee table, the taller Legion lady nodded and said,
"I believe it's always 3.
Rosemary agreed.
"That's what they say."
There was a knock at the front door, 3 short raps that might have come from beneath a conjurer's table. And when my father opened it, we heard his soft voice saying,
"Monsignor."
A single look went around the women in the room. You could feel the subject changing. Rosemary leaned over and turned on another light. The priest came into the living room just as the other 3 men came through the dining room to meet him. He shook hands all around. He was a heavy, scrubbed-looking man whose throat seemed to strain against his white collar just as his shoulders and broad chest seemed to strain against his black jacket and shirt front. Even his shiny scalp looked taut against his skull. And yet, for all this, there was an air of tremendous ease about him as he shook hands all around, like a politician, although he never ran for anything, making eye contact, "glad to see you," his palm warm and dry and encompassing. The taller Legion lady went to brew him his cup of tea, and I was dispatched by my father to go upstairs and let Maeve know. The stairs were carpeted, the same pale gray pile as in the living room. There was a wrought iron rail, open to the hallway halfway up, and then closed off by a wall. On the landing there was a round table draped with a pale blue cloth and covered with Hummel children, some of whom had black veins running across their legs and shoulders and through their necks, clearly places where they had been broken and then carefully repaired. Above this table was an oil portrait of the Christ child that to the uninitiated would seem to be a portrait of a beautiful and dark-skinned prepubescent girl. A framed cross-stitched copy of the Irish Blessing and another of the Prayer of St. Francis on the wall between the 2 bedrooms. The bathroom door at the head of the stairs was closed, and I could hear water running behind it. I glanced into Maeve's bedroom. Kate was sitting on the edge of the bed on a lovely ice-blue satin quilt that still bore the mark of where Maeve must have been napping when she heard Billy coming in. She held a life-size baby doll in her lap, cradling it. "Monsignor's here," I said, and Kate looked up. "Good," she said. She lifted the doll. It was dressed in a white crocheted sweater and cap and a long yellowing christening gown. A tiny blue medal on a scrap of pale blue ribbon was pinned to its collar. "This was Maeve's," she said, "this gown. She was christened in it." She turned to place the doll where it belonged, in the center of the bed between their two pillows. "Get this," Kate said, rearranging the doll's gown. "Maeve was just telling me that at the luncheon today, Ted Lynch went on about an order of nuns that takes widows. He said he'd give her the name of the mother house if she was interested." Kate rolled her eyes, blue eyes like Billy's. They seemed remarkably quick under the weight of her expensive eyeshadow. Her mouth had Billy's wry thinness. "Can you imagine?" she said. "An hour after a woman buries her husband, he's talking about her entering a convent? Can you imagine the gall?" I shook my head. I had no trouble imagining it. "What did Maeve think?" I asked. Kate waved her hand. Some of the makeup had settled into the creases around her eyes, the lines that framed her mouth. "Oh, you know Maeve, she told him she'd think about it." She reached out to smooth the christening dress over the doll's tiny booties. "It's the idea of being alone now, of course, that's getting to her, but I said, come on, when did Ted Lynch become this rabid Catholic?" She glanced toward the door, lowered her voice. "It's one of the problems with these ex-alcoholics," she said. "They still have to be rabid about something." She picked up the doll again. She seemed incapable of leaving it alone. "They should have had children," she said suddenly. "Billy and Maeve. They were both so fond of children." Behind her, the closet door was opened, showing the empty arms and shoulders of Billy's suits and shirts, his shoes lined up on the floor. There were two windows in the far wall, both of them draped with pale blue chintz over white shears. On the dresser between them was a photograph of Maeve and Billy coming down the aisle on their wedding day. Billy looking off to the side, acknowledging someone in a pew, it seemed. Maeve with her head down, her own smile nearly hidden. There was another old-fashioned photograph of a pretty young woman in a high lace collar, Maeve's mother, surely, and another framed snapshot, in pre-Kodachrome color, the tones slightly off, of Maeve's red-headed father looking startled, immobile, in one of the living room chairs. Billy's postcard from Long Island was stuck into the lower left-hand corner of the mirror. Home, sweet home. "Not that it would have changed what happened, but it would be something for Maeve now," Kate was saying, "to have a few children around." She smoothed the doll's gown, brushed at the bonnet, cradling it with what seemed half her attention, an old habit of motherhood. "You can't help but wonder what she got now." We heard the bathroom door opening at the end of the hall. "As if I should talk," Kate whispered. And then she put the doll back on the pillow. She said she'd tell Maeve the Monsignor was here. Downstairs, the priest had everyone in the living room laughing softly, teacups and saucers on their knees. The coffee table now held a plate of Dan Lynch's bakery cookies and another of small tea sandwiches, some ham and some cheese. Although he sat in one corner of the couch, legs crossed casually, thighs straining against the black fabric of his pants, elbow up over the plastic-covered armrest, the Monsignor was the center of everyone's attention. He had been recalling Billy. A Holy Name Society meeting, and the speaker going on for so long about the significance of the Paschal feast that Billy had leaned over and whispered into the Monsignor's ear that the hind leg of the Lamb of God with the little mint jelly sounded good to him. When Maeve descended the stairs a few minutes later, her sister-in-law behind her like a handmaiden, everyone stood as if for a meeting of dignitaries. Maeve put both her hands out for the priest, and the priest stepped toward her easily,
confidently, like an expert, a pro, like a slugger going to the plate or a surgeon to the operating table, a renowned attorney rising for his closing arguments. We all felt it, felt the tremendous sense of relief that we finally had among us someone who knew what he was doing. She wore brown slacks and a white sweater now, but nice ones, only a step down from her funeral dress. Not ready yet, perhaps, to put on her everyday clothes, to let Billy's death begin to be something less than an occasion.
"How are you, Maeve, my dear?"
the priest said, taking her hands, she still clutched a tissue in one of them, with perfect gentleness and sympathy, and an understanding that was bolstered, you saw it in his physical ease, his lingering smile, by his utter faith that death was not what we believed it to be tonight. Not at all. He apologized for not having made it to the funeral this morning. He'd been called to the hospital. Another soul rising, he implied. But she had been in his prayers all day long.
"How are you, then?"
he said. And once again, Maeve put a tissue to her eyes and began to cry. This time, none of us stirred. We simply stood, watching, as he put his arm around her shoulder and led her to the couch and sat beside her, his large hand covering both her own. Slowly, we all took our seats. It occurred to me that we were like a defeated bucket brigade, our wet and empty buckets dangling from our arms as we watched the fire chief drown a blaze that only minutes before we had merely splashed at.
"I thought I heard him coming in," she said, "earlier this evening."
And he nodded, expert in these matters, letting her speak, tell him what she'd felt, lying down in their darkened room, drifting off a bit, hearing the back door open and the dog coming in and the sound of his voice, and getting up and coming down here as if their lives were merely going on, and then realizing that he was gone.
"Gone, Father," she said.
The terror of it struck her then. His life was over. Hers was not. The priest nodded as she spoke. Everything in his face and his manner said he knew. He knew what she said, wanted to say, would say next. Had sat like this, his manner said, with so many other widows so many times before. When he finally replied, it was with an authority that superseded all our experience of Billy, superseded even Maeve's, my father's, his sister's long years. He was like a physician carrying reports to a waiting family, suddenly more expert than any of them about the dying man. More expert, everything in the priest's gracious manner seemed to say, because only he understood that death was nothing that it seemed to be to us tonight.
"Not over, Maeve,"
he said softly, scolding her, but fondly, gently.
"We are not abandoned, Maeve," he said. "You know that."
She bowed her head. Her tears, free-falling now, struck her lap, the back of his hand.
"Billy's life goes on in Christ."
With her head still down, she said again,
"I thought I heard him coming in."
The priest nodded politely.
"I understand," he said.
"I thought he was here,"
she repeated. He pursed his lips, biding his time, it seemed.
"It was another shock," he said. "But think of the joy he's found today, Maeve," he added softly, smiling. "The old reprobate. Think of the peace. Gone to his rest, Maeve," he said, "with the hope of rising again. The promise of rising again, Maeve, in the fulfillment of time. Think of that, if you can."
Maeve lifted her head but did not raise her eyes. You could see in the stubborn set of her jaw that it was not a figurative life that she wanted for Billy at this moment, but a literal one, his literal presence, coming in with the dog as she dozed, opening the cookie jar where they kept the dog biscuits, hanging the chain on a hook by the back door. Their life together.